From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Randall Lake is one of the most acclaimed painters in Utah. But he didn't begin here. He was born in California, went to college in Colorado, made his way to Paris, but an art teacher drew him to Utah, and this is where he stayed. He made a life here, a tumultuous life at times, became a Mormon, got married, had kids, came out as a gay man, left the church, but stayed in this place. Lake has said if you find the proper environment to express your personal vision, it doesn't matter where you are. When you're in the right place, he says, you'll know it. Next week, Lake is opening an exhibit of his work at his studio in downtown Salt Lake City. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation we had with him. We talked about place and art and, of course, life. Join us after the news.
My name is Angela H. Brown, and I'm the editor of Slug Magazine, which is an acronym for Salt Lake Underground. Ken Burns, that's doing the new Roosevelt documentary, was just interviewed by Doug Fabrizio for Radio West. And man, it was so cool to hear both of those very intelligent, talented, both masters of their own craft kind of get together and have a conversation. Doug, I think, is a real master of conversating. And then Ken is just such an artist. And so that was a driveway moment for me. I stayed in my car for 20 minutes too long listening to their interview. And I knew I could podcast it later on and listen to it, but the conversation was so compelling that I just didn't want it to end. I didn't want to save it for later. I needed that inspiration at that moment. That's one of the reasons why I am a sustainer, that way I donate every single month to KUER.
It's KUER Spring Fund Drive. If Radio West is important to you, we hope you'll consider a gift to the station. You can become a sustaining member for as little as $10 a month. Go online to KUER.org to make your pledge. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There was a time, not so long ago, when the painter Randall Lake defended traditional realism as a form. It was a style that brought him a lot of attention and acclaim. In fact, he's become one of the most esteemed artists in the country for his subdued portraits and landscapes and still-life images. But life changes, of course, and so has Lake's perspective. These days, he's infusing his iconic portraits with bright, saturated colors, for example. And maybe that's a reflection of the drastic changes in his own life, the transition several years ago now from being a Mormon man painting safe subjects to living openly gay, painting more subversive scenes. Randall Lake has said facing the unknown is vastly more satisfying than trying to repeat past successes. Lake is opening a new exhibit called Paris Rock and Roll, which opens April 23rd. It runs through the 27th. At his studio in the Guthrie Building in downtown Salt Lake City. We'll put the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Randall Lake has had a studio in downtown Salt Lake City in the Guthrie Building there for 40 years now. He also has a studio in Spring City, Utah. Randall Lake, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start, I guess let's go back, way back first. You were born in California. Your family owned owned a few golf courses.
My dad was a golf pro.
He was
pro.
A golf pro.
Right.
But this was the question, though. Are you much of a golfer? Not at all. That didn't take?
No, I have two brothers, and they're both golfers, and my dad's a golfer, and I was sort of the decorative plant.
What does that mean?
Well, I mean, I like classical music and, drawing, and I wasn't really – I did play water polo and swam in high school,
Yeah.
But golf, I told my dad, I said, it's a game for old men and idiots.
Did you know, when you imagined your life, when you thought about it when you were young, did you imagine yourself as a painter ever in those early days?
No, actually, I wanted to be a composer.
Really?
Yeah. I was really interested in that. I took piano lessons and, got pretty good at it. But, my parents, you could tell that they didn't want me to do something that was impractical. And so even though I really liked to paint, you couldn't make a living at it. So I went to the University of Colorado and got a bachelor's in English.
Yeah.
Well, that guarantees unemployment.
Right.
You know. No, but actually it did get me a job. You know, because of that, I got a very fine letter of recommendation from somebody in Boulder that knew the people in Paris, and so I got this job as a lecturer for 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Which, you also attended a private boarding school in Switzerland,
right,
for a time.
Yeah,
did
I
you
was 12.
When you were 12, did you want to be there?
No, that's just what my family did. They just put me in this school and left.
You took a degree in English, as you said, the University of Colorado, which made me wonder, which is more meaningful in your life, do you think, in some way? And I'm wondering if you even put these in segregated places. You know, which is more meaningful? English, you know, literature, which is important to you, I know. Music, which is important to you, I know. Or art, or do you even separate them in some way?
Well, yeah, art's what's making me a living.
Yeah.
And it's my own, you know.
Yeah.
And I love it. I love the job because nobody can fire me. You know, and I think when I was in France, you know, I got this scholarship for a year to have a studio that was subsidized right on the Seine.
Wow.
And the competition to get those studios was horrific. And I got one, and I thought, if they think I'm good enough to get one of these scholarships, then I'm going to be a painter. And then the other idea was, since I was becoming a Mormon, I realized I was kind of saying goodbye to my sexuality. And so I thought, you know, if that's out of the picture, I can at least do what I want. So, you know, I was committed to being a painter.
Wait, so, and I will come back to this in a moment, but so art, well, you were sublimating with art.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I wonder if when you were in Europe, I mean, this was 67 and 68. It was a really tumultuous time.
Oh, I was in those riots in Paris, May of 68. Every night I was down there with a wetted handkerchief around my nose, and we were building barricades, you know, and fighting the police.
Yeah. Did you love it there? I mean, what was it?
It was fabulous.
Yeah. Why? Why was it fabulous?
There was a sense of camaraderie and, you know, and sort of a us against them. Like, you know, the Spanish Civil War, it was fabulous. And they closed the Sorbonne where I was going to school, so I found an art school and went off and did that, you know.
Yeah.
But it changed the whole psychology of Paris. I mean, people were giving people rides. I mean, it was all the barriers went down.
I've heard you talk about some of the paintings that you've admired too. Manet was one.
Oh, yeah. My early heroes. You know, my very earliest was Modigliani.
Oh, really?
And then, you know, when I met Gittins, it was at Whistler, Manet, and Sargent.
Yeah.
And although during the time I was in Paris, I was blending pop art with Matisse and... It was Villon, Jacques Villon.
Mm.
You know, Matisse's woman with a green stripe. You know, I was adding elements of that into the pop art.
Do you remember when you first saw a painting like that? Like, do you remember, like, did they create a flash, you know, like some sort of epiphany for you in some way?
Well, how do you mean? Did I see a Warhol itself?
No, or anything. Like when you saw Matisse for the first time, was there something where you thought, that is unbelievable to me, that knocks me out?
Oh, gosh. You know, that's ancient history.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't remember, you know, actually I've never thought about it before. But I mean, I've always been, I'll tell you more recently, you know, the Bellagio in Las Vegas for a while had some of the Phillips collection, and they had like three or four Cezannes.
Yeah.
And that charged me so much that it affected my painting for a year. And I can show you in my collection, you know, the paintings that I did that were inspired from those Cezannes. I mean, it was unbelievable to see them in the flesh.
Yeah.
Same with Van Gogh, you know, because half of their beauty is their texture.
Really,
which you don't see, see in a book, you know.
Yeah. So how did that change your technique, the way you used the paint?
Oh, it changed my colors.
Yeah.
I mean, God, what a colorist he was, you know. Yeah, I do get inspired by things, and then I'll do. You know, Picasso said that a painter is a collector that can't afford to collect, and so he paints for himself the paintings that he can't afford. You know, and I think that's very true, because I remember, you know, I was doing these big ducks in brass buckets and stuff,
yeah.
And that was from Emil Carlson at the LA County Museum, and then I would do something else, and you know, like my skier, my cross country skier, that's a full standing. That was after Manet's The Pfeiffer. You know,
right?
Yeah.
Right.
So I mean, there are. I can show you references for all of my major work. You know.
Yeah. You mentioned Gittins. Let me say it's Alvin Gittins, of course. This was someone had suggested to you. This is you're in Paris, and they said, yeah. You know, you should go work with Alvin Gittins.
Right.
To talk a little bit about him, it's interesting because he kind of rejected you at first. He didn't think he didn't think you were all that. You thought you were all that.
No. I mean, he was sure I thought I was all that.
Yeah.
You know, but he was instantly prejudiced. You know, I was too old. I wore silk ties. You know, he just wasn't about any of that, you know. And at one point he said to me, he said, you're old and you're stiff and you just don't have it.
How did you react to that?
I died. You know, I just went home and died.
But you didn't give up.
Mm-mm.
You sort of followed him here.
Yeah, I came here for him.
This was 1973.
Yeah. But, you know, I realized after all this happened that I was the first graduate student to ask him to chair my graduate committee. He had never chaired a graduate committee for anybody. Mm. And, you know, he had a lot of enemies because he would shoot down the abstract students, you know. And so he knew that whoever he was, you know, fronting had to be faultless.
Yeah.
And so he made sure I was, you know, before he let me into the program.
Well, you took a drawing class of his something like five times? Is that right?
No, maybe four. I took him for 4 years, just him. That was the best thing that ever happened to me, you know. I mean, if you wanted to learn academic chiaroscuro, alla prima painting, he was the man to do it. Now he would be making money just painting. He wouldn't be teaching.
Right.
So it was a lucky, lucky thing, you know.
What was he like? Was he kind at all?
He was brilliant.
Yeah.
And he was extremely critical. And one time he told me, he said, you know, you must judge my affection for you in terms of criticism. You know?
So you trusted him?
Oh, absolutely. You know, absolutely.
The idea of, we'll talk about what you're painting these days, but I'm wondering, your perception of reality, sort of the realism phase for a while. I mean, I've been reading about some of the things that you used to talk about related to that. You said that you tried not to transform reality.
Boy, I've done a 180 on that one.
I was going to say, I mean, it seems like you're not – I mean, so – but let's talk about the way you were thinking of it then, because then it seems like you wanted to be like Gittins in some way, sort of stand firm against all of the change that was going on, right?
Right, yeah.
So how were you thinking of realism in those ways? I mean, were you thinking of it as – I mean, was it just a way of standing firm with him, or did you feel strongly about realism in those days? Does that make sense?
You know, I guess it was important to me to know how to draw and do things correctly.
Yeah.
I mean, it was important to me, and especially as a portrait painter, you know. So, you know, for 30 years or whatever, you know, I did, you know, very exact stuff. And then something just started to happen, and it was like it wasn't interesting anymore, you know. It's like when you go to art school, you learn to tell the truth, you know, to get it right. And then as an artist, as a mature artist, you learn to lie and lie successfully, you know. And I finally realized that it's the mistakes that are interesting, you know. I mean, nobody's looking at Bonnard and Meissonier. They're looking at Cézanne and Gauguin. You know, nothing's right in this Cézanne. I mean, you know, if that's your issue, you know, it's not going to.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you were doing these realistic portraits, which got you a lot of attention, got you a lot of fame, did you feel like it's a job? It's not it's not art. Or
oh, no, no. I never had that.
No.
You know, I know it's regarded as like being a tailor. I mean, you know, portrait painters do not fare well in art history unless they're like Van Dyke, you know. Most people look at portraits. Well, most people that know art and travel in art circles, you know, think of portraitists as kind of like tailors. You know, they're doing somebody else's job.
It's funny, you've talked about in those days that you preferred to, you know, some portrait artists, they're fine with a photo. You never liked that. You like them to be there.
Oh, no. I mean, you can't do a decent portrait off of – you're getting a one-second image of these people in a photograph, you know. And when you paint them live, you get to know them and you get to know their clothing. And, you know, and they'll come in and their hair will be different one day. And you'll – you know, one day you'll put the smile in because you're talking about funny things, you know. But it's absolutely night and day, you know.
But so you can't fix them? You can't settle them just in one spot. It's not just one dimension, a portrait. Is that what you're saying?
No.
It's more dynamic, right?
Well, I'm sure. When you're doing a portrait, it helps to have the person there because you get to know them. And you get to know, you know, things will happen in one sitting that won't happen in the next sitting, you know. So it's a conglomerate of, you know, things you're putting up there, but it's the best elbow, and it's the best shadow on the jacket, it's the best smile, it's the best way he wears his hair, you know. And so you get the best of everything. And, photographs distort, you know, whatever is closest to the lens is bigger.
Yeah.
So you'll paint these tarantula hands on a, you know, on a face is small and the hands are huge. I mean, I did have to do that when I was called on to paint people that were dead.
Well, there's a story I wanted to ask you about that in particular. Yeah. This industrialist, this millionaire guy who owned the Cleveland Indians.
Oh, yeah. David Jacobs.
David Jacobs. Now, he was – you had been commissioned to do this. He was dead. He was dead and gone.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you go about this? I love this story, actually, because it's such a weird story with the family sort of getting involved. Tell the story, because you put this thing together and the family doesn't like it at first.
Okay. All right. So I get this commission through my art dealer in San Francisco, you know, and the Jacobs have bought lots of my work.
Yeah.
And, you know, for them and everything. So I'm going to do him from a photograph, but they can't seem to find any real photographs. I mean, the only good ones are like his wedding photos, and they come up with this little brownie of him and his brother in a shopping mall, you know, and his head's about as big as your little finger, you know. And I'm just going, how am I going to do this? And they wanted him standing in front of a Frederick Waugh seascape.
Yeah.
It's worth millions, you know. And, you know, of course, that wasn't going to be shipped to Salt Lake, and I'm glad it wasn't. But so I got a big blow-up of that, you know, for the background. And then I did the best I could, and then it was shipped to Cleveland, and I went out to Cleveland. And she was happy with it, but then the president of the company would come and say, no, he was bulkier. So then his jacket went out, and then in the weekend his jacket went in. And it was one of those, like, pin the tail on the donkey thing. And, I mean, I was going through packs of cigarettes, you know. I was just a wreck. I mean, it was like, whatever, you know. I hated that painting so much by the time I finished it. And then the kicker was, you know, I flew back, and my dealer calls me from San Francisco and says, they want, I think, two more. Like, do two more copies of this that I hated from the beginning.
Right.
And I mean, I just said, no, I can't. I mean, I'm sorry. And we finally decided to make a giclée for them. But can you imagine doing two copies of a painting you hated? Because copies are harder than the original, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, that was a nightmare.
Yeah. Do you feel like you ever got it right?
Yeah, I did. You know, I mean, I have pretty high standards. And so make sure it's right on, you know, to my lights, yeah.
Yeah. What did you like about landscapes?
Well, they're relaxing. They're
really
forgiving.
Yeah.
I mean, if this tree doesn't have the exact shape, you know, like in a portrait, it's still going to be okay. Nobody's going to know that, you know, that branch wasn't there. So it's relaxing, and it allows you to basically paint just as freely as you want. You know, there's no constraints. You know, whereas a commissioned portrait, they're you know, they're only going to be 10 sittings, and yeah, you've got to do it in 10 sittings because time is money. You know, for these people.
Yeah.
And so I would say, you know, landscape's relaxing. And it doesn't have to say anything about anything, just landscape.
Yeah. Do you try to do them in one sitting?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I admire LeConte Stewart. You know, in his painting days, he would do 12. He would do two 12 by 16s and two 24 by 30s in one day.
Wow.
That just blows me away, you know.
There's a cover. There's a landscape painting you did from Manti. It shows the Manti Temple. And it was featured on the Ensign magazine.
This is a
magazine of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day
Saints. Okay, I've got to tell you a story.
Okay.
I needed to get elevation for this painting. And so I set up on top of my Volkswagen van and was painting it from the van. And in the foreground, right in my line of vision, was this old farm, you know. And so this guy comes out and visits with me, and he starts telling me about the guy that lives in the old farm. And he says, you know, his wife is Indian, and one day I was in there in the kitchen, and she came in, and she was swatting flies, and he said, what are you doing, making a sandwich? I mean, stuff like that for me is just priceless, you know. I love that, you know.
You love what? The interaction with people, the stories.
To interact with them and the fact that they came up with something like that, you know.
The artist Randall Lake. Next week, there's a new showing of his work at his studio in downtown Salt Lake City. The show is called Paris Rock and Roll. You can get more details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we'll be broadcasting our conversation with the painter Randall Lake. He's one of Utah's most esteemed artists, and like many before him, he traveled to Europe early in his life to hone his craft. And it was in France where he really discovered Utah. So he came here, and his pictures have reflected his own journey from landscapes to portraits and his more daring recent work. Lake is opening a new exhibit on April 23rd. It's called Paris Rock and Roll. It runs through April 27th at his studio in the Guthrie Building in downtown Salt Lake City. We'll put the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. What did you think of Utah when you first came here?
From Paris?
Yeah.
It's a good thing I had art to save me because, I mean, I died, you know. I mean, I missed, you know, the cafes and the flea market and going to museums and, you know, the art supplies. And I mean, it was so totally different. But, you know, I felt like this was the right thing to do, you know.
Why?
Well, I wanted to, as a Mormon, you know, I wanted to paint like temple murals and portraits of the church. And of course, they're only interested in realism, you know. So I was trying to, you know, get my skills together because in Paris, nobody was teaching realism. Nobody was teaching academic. I mean, they just looked at you like, what are you thinking, you know? Very unpopular.
Yeah. What is it that – what's the thing that brought you to Mormonism? You weren't born Mormon. You became baptized later. What was it about Mormonism? Was it one thing in particular that drew you to the faith?
You know, I think the big thing was that this girlfriend I had, she sent – that it was a Mormon in California. She sent me to Paris a book by President Kimball called The Miracle of Forgiveness.
Wow. For a gay man to read that book, that must have been
– Yeah. And, you know, I really at that point wanted to be straight in the worst way.
Yeah.
And so I kind of followed the recipe and, you know, I got married and had kids and – you know, everything, you know.
Wait, so being a Mormon in some way was a way to kind of deal with your sexuality?
Well, they said that it would go away, you know, that I'd be straight if I did everything, you know, that I could, you know. So that's what I was hoping.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
When you got married?
Yeah.
Did you think you were making a mistake in the back of your mind that this, I shouldn't be doing this, I can't do this?
You know, it was a conscious, you know, it was kind of an auto da fe, but it was really a conscious thing that because as a gay man, I got my heart broken enough to know that I just couldn't live that way. I would die. I mean, it was so painful and so intense. And there were no...
Why? Because you had to wander around in secret? Was that what you meant?
No. Just the pain of having an affair with a man and having it not work.
Yeah.
It was so, you know, so difficult for me, you know. And there were no role models at all that were healthy. Nothing in film, nothing. The only thing I can think of is like Midnight Cowboy, where, you know, it was just awful. I mean, if that's what it was, it's like, I don't want to do that, you know?
Yeah.
So I didn't feel like there was an alternative. I didn't see anybody that was living a happy gay life, you know, with a partner.
It's interesting. You said that you had to wait until your father and Gittins died.
Yeah.
Before you came out.
Yeah, my two father figures.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why?
Oh, because neither one of them would have dealt with that at all, you know, very well, at all. You know, I mean, my dad must have known, but we never talked about it.
He must have known.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sometimes we'd be in the kitchen and before dinner and he'd be having a cocktail and he'd say, "Randy, do you still like girls?" Well, no dad asks his son that, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Gittins the same? Can you imagine? I mean, what would it have been like if you would have... Question is, did he know, do you think?
I think, you know, he was a very good student of human nature, and he probably thought, I didn't know, which is true. There are people that don't confront it, you know. But I remember Gittins' reaction when Dan Baxter came out, you know, and that was his star student, you know, and he just felt like it was a weakness and a shame and, you know, like, oh, you know, too bad.
Does that change your perspective of Gittins? I mean, you have such a regard for him.
No. I think Gittins and my dad did the best they knew how to do, you know, in the time that they lived in, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the thing that finally helped you come out and say openly, I'm gay?
A suicide.
Yeah.
It put me out of the closet like a cannonball.
Do you mind saying something about that? This was a lover, a partner?
Yeah, uh-huh. But we were both in the church, you know, and...
two closeted gay Mormon men.
Right. He was a stake organist and I was a Sunday school teacher. And it lasted a year and then... you know, I knew I was falling in love with him hard, and I couldn't leave, you know, six people for one.
Right.
I said, I just can't do that, you know.
He said, you mean you're talking about your kids?
Yeah, and my wife, you know. And he said, you know, I understand. And, you know, next day he was dead.
How did you react to that at the time?
Oh, gosh. I was skiing with my daughters. I mean, I was a wreck, you know. And then they put me in the psych ward. And, you know, I was a mess, a real mess.
At what point did you figure you couldn't live as a Mormon?
That did it.
That was it?
Yeah.
So it wasn't related to necessarily what you believed about the church or the doctrines necessarily. It was just that component of it. Is that right?
Well, as far as gayness, you know, they got it completely wrong, you know. And the trouble is that policy kills people. You know.
But what about the other part? I guess you can't separate the other part, the doctrinal part, the stuff that, I mean, surely that drew you as well, the spiritual part, right?
Yeah, right, yeah. I think, I mean, I have such a revulsion against organized religion. I mean, it just did. It did me in, you know, for everything.
Yeah.
So it disillusioned me, you know.
Right. You know, it's interesting that. I mean, I had read somewhere, and I'm not sure if this is true, Randall, but your wife at some point had said she would rather you were dead than to shame the children.
You know, that's a misquote.
Is it?
Yeah, it didn't happen. She was much kinder to me.
Well, you guys get along really well now, as I understand.
We go on family trips and Christmas and Spring City and whatever, you know.
Yeah. So it's painful to hear quotes like that.
Pardon me?
It's painful to hear quotes like that. I mean, it must have been hard for her, of course.
To what?
What must have been hard for your wife to hear you say, I'm a gay man and I have to leave this relationship.
Yeah, oh, sure. You know, the nice thing, I mean, the thing that I feel good about is that I did take her down to the river in Paris and talk to her about my gay experiences before we got married, you know. So she wasn't in the dark about it.
Right. One profile I read of you, Randall, suggested that you had spent your life being well-behaved to compensate for being gay.
Yeah.
Is it true?
Yeah, really. No, I mean, I never rocked the boat. You know, I was the peacemaker. You know, I always did the right thing, you know. Yeah, I mean, there was a tremendous amount of guilt and self-loathing for being gay, even as a kid. You know, you just pick that up from the society.
And so then
like
once,
osmosis.
Right. So then once you leave Mormonism, and you're angry enough, I guess, on some levels, how did that start to change your work then?
Oh, I mean, I don't think it happened right. Yeah, it did. Pretty much very soon after that, you know, I painted a portrait of Farrell hanging himself in his basement in his garments. And my San Francisco dealer just flipped when he got that. You know, but, you know, I painted a whole series of one like there's a general authority behind a pulpit. And above him, like a super title, it says, you know, with prayer, baseball, dot, you know, there are different things that they suggest will make you straight, you know. And then behind him are gay men that have hung themselves, and in front of the podium, there are gay men that have shot themselves, you know, that were, you know, trying to make these things work. The title of that one is something like medical advice worthy of Joseph Mengele.
Mengele. You know. So this, how do you explain that period now? I mean, that full of rage, a lot of anger, a lot of anguish.
Yeah.
I mean, there's one famous painting that features a man. I think this was a partner of yours too, holding the head of Gail Ruzicka.
Oh yeah.
As Medusa.
Right. Yeah. I don't know what to say about that. I mean. You know, of course we can't stand people like her, you know. And it was a good idea, I thought. It was based on a Klimt. I don't spend time out, you know, marching in the streets and, you know, being on committees. Where I'm useful as an activist is in my art, you know. And that's where I'd like to keep it. And like I did one about the Proposition 8, which is one of my favorites. It's got Satan as an organ grinder. So he's like grinding a street organ, and the street organ's in the shape of the temple. And he's holding up in his other hand a married couple, like on the top of a wedding cake, a straight married couple, you know. And all the people behind him are like homosexuals from Germany's camps, you know, with the upside down triangle. And then this little monkey in the foreground's, you know, going around collecting money. And it says, for this you must pay, meaning that, you know, they're not going to give marriage to us for you know, an eternity.
Yeah. Strong stuff.
Huh?
Strong stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's take a call from Tom. Tom, welcome.
Hello. I've got a question for Randall about a portrait that he did of a friend of mine who I used to cross-country ski with a lot, called Bruce. Bruce dressed in really bright colored outfits back then, and I wonder if Randall could tell me the circumstances behind that painting.
This is the cross-country ski? Is it the kind of a famous piece?
Yeah, 1972.
Yeah.
Oh, I was driving on 13th East in my Volkswagen, and I came to the intersection of 4th South and 13th, and Bruce was crossing the street wearing exactly, you know, what I painted. And I was so taken by it that I pulled over, put my emergency – actually, I didn't even get my car out of the traffic. I just put my emergency brake on and ran to him and said, please go home and write down everything you're wearing and bring it and paint, and I'll pay you $6 an hour, you know, to paint, to model for me. And he said, fine. So he gets to my studio like a week later, and he comes up and he stands over by the wall and says, what should I do? And I said, that's it. That's perfect. You know, stop.
Yeah.
And so I don't remember how many sittings I did, but it was a great painting, and one of my early great ones, I think. And it was based on Manet's The Fife Player,
yeah.
You know. And it eventually sold to a family in Salt Lake for $28,000. And anyway, it's on its way.
Tom, thanks very much. You've been painting the Guthrie Building for 40 years now. Do you realize it's been 40 years?
Well, I know it's hard to believe. You know, you wake up and you're dead.
What do you like about that space?
Oh, I like the height of the ceilings. I like the fact that it's got so much north light. I like that it's an old building and I can nail in the walls and, you know, break things and spill on the floor. Yeah, there's nothing not to like about it, really. I mean, you know, in Paris, it's the most valuable and important thing and the rarest thing you could have is a studio because of the rents, you know. And so the last studio I had in Paris before I came to Salt Lake was a little maid's room over on the Rue de Grenelle. In the 7th floor, you know, looking at the Eiffel Tower, no running water, no stairs, and I was paying 300 francs a month rent, which was $60. Hmm. And believe me, you know, it was cramped. And I came to Salt Lake and found this. It was 3 rooms, all utilities and parking, $40 a month. I was in heaven.
You also have a place, an old former LDS endowment house in Spring City.
Yeah, I do.
You paint there very often these days?
You know, not as much as I used to because it's a lot of work. I mean, I've kept it sort of 19th century, which sounds really nice, but it's a pain in the ass.
Right.
You know, but, you know, you've got to, like, you know, pump the water and make a fire in the stove and, you know, put coal in the thing and change the candles and... Anyway, so I don't as often as I used to, but I still do it, yeah.
When you are painting, let's say at the Guthrie.
Yeah.
What's the first thing you do? Do you play the piano?
You know, I used to have a piano there.
Yeah.
And I do have a beautiful piano in my home, and I used to play the piano. But lately, I haven't for years, you know.
Really?
I don't know why. It's just like I'm using everything I can to put into my painting.
Yeah.
But I do have rituals before I start to paint. And I find that the older I get, the longer the rituals, you know. Like I'll come in, you know, I'll turn the heaters on. I'll change into my painting clothes. I'll sit down at my desk. I'll look over what I'm supposed to do. You know, I'll do just desk work for a while.
Yeah.
And then I will... sit on the bed for maybe 15 minutes and read a part of my book, you know?
Yeah.
And then I start. And then I go to the easel. And then I've got to, you know, clean my brushes out and choose the painting or whatever and then get all ready to start.
Right.
Load my palette.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think there were a lot of people who wondered if you were going to stop doing it. People worried about you for a time.
Yeah.
And they wondered if you were going to exhibit again.
Me too. Hey, I thought it was over, really.
Why? Why?
Well, because I had no feeling that it would ever change. It just felt like I was, you know, in this just depressive state that was going to go on forever, you know.
Like in a rut?
Well, I don't know whether it was a rut, because it was like I just felt dead. You know, my heart was dead. My motivation was dead. You know, it was like, why bother, you know? I forget what got me out of it, you know.
You do? You forget what got you out of it?
Oh, part of it was that I started teaching a girl at my studio. She comes once a week, you know, and she loves it. She's an excellent painter, and it's been good for both of us. So that was a big plus, you know.
What do you think, like, what is a Randall Lake now? Like, you know, like people say, what is a Randall Lake going to be now? Like, do you even know what that is?
You know, you and I both would like to know. And you know, one of my goals as a painter recently is, what's a Randall Lake about a Randall Lake? I mean, what distinguishes this as a Randall Lake? Because, I mean, anybody can paint good florals or still lives, you know, or portraits. So what, you know? And so I'm trying to find out, you know, what's personal or what I have to say that is personal. And that's a lot more work than just copying reality. You know, it is.
Yeah. Harder.
Yeah. Scarier.
Scarier.
But
you like being there, though.
Yeah, it's the only way to go. You know, there's nothing worse than, you know, copying old recipes. And I mean, that would be pure death, you know, to do that.
Yeah, you know, you must be having fun with color these days.
Oh, yeah. You know, you should see my paint bill.
Really?
It's an absolute fortune. Yeah.
You know, you once said in an interview that you grew up in Orange County. You've mm-hmm. lived in Utah since 1973, but your goal is Paris.
Well, everybody's goal is Paris. I mean, you know, to go to heaven is like... I can't imagine, for me, a place I'd love more, you know, than living in Paris, but I don't want to do it like I used to, like in my salad days when I was living in a maid's room. You know,
right.
It was fun then, you know, at 30 or 20, but not now. I don't want to do it like that.
Yeah. So you feel somewhat content to sort of stick around here then, for now at least?
Well, you know, with my mental issues, you know, my feeling, you know, lately, I mean, it's behind me now, but when they were bad, it would have done me no good at all to go to Paris, because you take your brain with you.
Right.
So, you know, I'm glad to be here to get this completely over with, and then, you know, that's the first thing I want to do. Yeah.
Yeah. The artist Randall Lake. On April 23rd, he's hosting an exhibit of his work. The show is called Paris Rock and Roll. It runs through April 27th. You can find details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.